Cleve looked at Nora, Nora looked at Grant, and Grant looked at Kane. He didn't immediately notice the visual scrutiny because he was leaning over the display boards, trying to reason out all the glowing icons. Finally, he sensed the pressure of three pairs of eyes and turned.
What?
Nora spoke up first.
We need a plan.
Yeah, it's all well and good to talk about stealing a Tav and flying up to the Devil platform.
But we need a proactive bridge between the theoretical and the practical.
By that, I take it you mean we need to figure out how to get out of here. Is that why you're all looking at me?
Actually, they were looking at me, and I looked over at you, since you're usually the one who comes up with all the strategies.
Which you usually say amounts to me making up shit as I go along, when they pan out at all.
As much as I hate to admit it, your track record for plans is pretty good.
Hell of a time for you to finally tell me that.
Grant lifted the broad yoke of his shoulders in a shrug.
It's on my mind at the moment, that's all.
Kane started to pace around the dome-roof chamber, encountered the leading edge of the blood puddle, and changed direction.
Instead of food and water, I wish they'd send in a mop and bucket.
I don't think they're worried about us starving to death. They expect us to die of old age long before that happens.
Kane smiled, then winced. He touched his bruised cheek.
You sure you're all right?
Yeah, the suit pretty much absorbed the worst of it. I bet he has about 5 times my strength, so if he had hit me full in the head...
His words trailed off, eyes going vacant. He gazed down at the pool of dark blood. Grant noticed the faraway sheen in his eyes and completed Kane's sentence.
If he'd hit you full in the head, you'd be dead.
Very much so.
Yeah, but Mac didn't hit you in the head. We all know that, right?
Grant stepped toward the door.
Right. But Saladin doesn't know Mac didn't hit him in the head. He was out on the catwalk. He saw Mac hit Kane and knock him on his ass.
On my back.
On his back. But he didn't see you get up.
Nora's eyes widened, darting back and forth between the two men in confusion.
What does that have to do with anything?
I see. You'll play dead, lie doggo in here. We tried to get somebody to open the door and fetch your body.
Grant nodded approvingly in his direction, tapping the side of his head with an index finger.
Now you're getting it.
Cleve glowered at him.
If I can get it, so can Saladin.
Not necessarily.
Why should any of Mac's boys give a damn about a dead man locked up with live ones?
You've got a point, Cleve. But they carted Majira's body away, right? And Saladin is human even if Mac isn't. There's such a thing as morbid curiosity.
Exactly. Saladin, or whoever, may be interested in seeing the kind of damage their demon prince did to the Outlander. They sure seem to get a kick out of watching him decapitate Majira.
Kane glanced questioningly at Nora.
Where would they have taken Majira's body?
Probably to the drainage ditch. It flows to the hydroponic garden section of the base, and as she decomposes, she'll serve as fertilizer.
Appropriate.
You'll have to lie down in the blood again.
Kane hesitated, then shrugged diffidently.
All part of the employment contract. Let's do it.
Sitting down on the deck and scooting backward, Kane followed Grant's instructions and carefully arranged his body in a position approximating where it had been after McCann hammered him off his feet. Grant dipped his fingertips into the blood and smeared it over Kane's face. Kane squeezed his eyes shut and tolerated the daubing without protest, but Nora hugged herself and shuddered.
Oh, disgusting!
Kane lowered the back of his head into the puddle.
You only have to watch it.
Grant examined him, made a couple of suggestions, then went to the door and began pounding on it with his fists. He punctuated his drumming blows with bellows.
Hey! Saladin, anybody! We got a dead man in here! That pointy-eared psycho of yours killed Kane. Open up!
Cleve and Nora moved to the far wall of the chamber and stood shoulder to shoulder, while Grant continued banging and kicking on the portal. For several minutes he shouted, cajoled, and finally begged.
Please, get him out of here! We can't stand it! His brains are leaking out of his ears!
Finally, out of breath and hoarse, he stopped, turning to face Kane, Cleve, and Nora.
He's not buying it.
Maybe nobody is out there.
Or maybe they just don't give a shit.
Kane lifted his head slightly.
That's probably the most likely explanation. But let's not give up yet. It's the only plan we have.
There's no point to it. We're dreaming. We need to accept the reality that we are all going...
The locking solenoids clacked so loudly and unexpectedly, everyone in the room jumped. Even Kane's legs jerked in startlement. The thick panel slid aside a few feet, then stopped. The sectionalized barrel of a plasma rifle poked in between the edge of the door and the frame. The barrel terminated in a long cylinder, reminiscent of an oversized sound suppressor. Saladin spoke from the other side of the door.
Back away.
Grant did as he said, raising his hands.
Kane's dead. I think every bone in his skull is broken.
The door opened all the way and Saladin stepped in. Without being obvious about it, Grant looked beyond him. The catwalk behind him was empty. Saladin waggled the barrel of his weapon meaningfully and menacingly.
All the way back, Grant. You know the drill.
Grant shuffled backward, talking as rapidly as he knew how.
McCann killed him with one blow. Never saw anything like it. Just pow!
As he passed Kane, he saw his friend lying as he had seen corpses lie, arms and legs bent unnaturally and stiffly, head slightly to one side. Saladin wasn't immediately gulled. He approached Kane warily, cautiously, shifting his gaze constantly from Grant to Kane. When Saladin reached Kane's splayed legs, he nudged his feet with a boot. The corresponding loose wobble was satisfactory, and he moved closer, scrutinizing Kane's blood-streaked face.
He hemorrhaged like hell.
Saladin's lips twitched, either in a brief smile or a grimace.
Your friend seems very dead. If it means anything, I'm sorry. He wasn't our enemy, but he was very foolish to attack Mac.
Are you going to cart him out of here?
Saladin peered at him contemptuously.
Why should I bother? The sight of death may disturb you, who was born on Earth in a different time. But it's all part of my existence.
You took Majira's body.
I had help then. No, he must stay where he lays. But I'll do you a favor and make him less of an obstacle.
Saladin pointed his plasma rifle down, training the bore on Kane's midsection.
It'll stink in here for a few minutes, but at least he'll be out of your way.
Through slitted eyes, Kane waited, watched, and then he gathered himself. With all the speed his years of training and honed reflexes had given him, his right hand lashed up and tightened around the weapon's barrel. He sprang up, first to a squat, then to a crouch. Saladin reacted almost instantaneously, pulling back on the rifle, trying to wrench it from Kane's grasp. Kane wrestled with it, forcing the barrel straight up toward the dome arching overhead. Grant lunged forward, and Saladin, snarling in a language neither man understood, pivoted at the waist, putting Kane in Grant's path. Kane resisted the maneuver, hands tight around the weapon. For a long second, he and Saladin stood eye to eye.
Drop it! You fire that thing now and you'll...
Saladin drove his head forward, butting Kane in the forehead. Kane staggered, but retained his grip on the plasma rifle. Then, either by accident or intentionally, Saladin depressed the trigger plate. A crackling fountain of blue energy flared out of the barrel and splashed against the underside of the dome. Saladin's face twisted in shock. His mouth worked, but whatever he had to say dissolved in a prolonged, screeching rumble. The dome exploded into fragments, but none of the pieces fell into the chamber. Propelled by the atmospheric pressure within, all the shards ballooned upward and outward into the hard vacuum of the lunar surface. A great cyclonic wind gusted all around them, trying to sweep them off their feet. Kane released the plasma rifle and grabbed the edge of the console. Legs flailing, Saladin clung to a panel with both hands, his body in a straining horizontal posture as he struggled desperately against the relentless drag of depressurization. His fingers slipped, and as if jerked by an invisible wire, Saladin plunged up, feet first, into the cloud of frozen oxygen and half-slag dome shards at the apex of the breach. Kane felt a giant's hand snatch him, wrenching him upward. He braced his arms and fought the powerful, incessant suction, dragging himself along the curving instrument console toward the open door. Throwing himself headlong, he hooked his fingers into the narrow slot of the doorframe. His legs kicked, still drawn upward by the maelstrom of decompression. He felt a hand close over the toe of his left boot. Kane hazarded a glance over his shoulder and saw Grant latched onto his foot with one hand while the other gripped Nora's forearm. Cleve wrapped both arms around Nora's waist, and his lower body bobbed toward the shattered roof. All of their faces were twisted in a rictus of strain, pain, and sheer terror. Kane laboriously dragged himself forward until he was able to brace his arms against the doorframe. Grant lunged desperately, shifting his grip from Kane's foot to his ankle. He pulled, slowly starting to climb Kane's leg like a rope, his fingers digging deep. Arms trembling with the effort of keeping himself braced in position, Kane waited until Grant was able to clasp onto the doorframe. Both men performed slow horizontal chin-ups, struggling to lever themselves out of the chamber. With his longer reach, Grant managed to grab a crossbar of the catwalk's guardrail and with a muscle-tearing effort jerked himself free of the epicenter of decompression. Hand over hand, he pulled out Kane, Nora, and then Cleave. Before Cleave's toes had fully cleared the threshold, Grant slapped the control buttons and the portal slid shut. Gasping, Kane kicked Cleave's feet out of the way as the door sealed with a muffled thud. Their ears felt as if they were stuffed with soggy cotton wadding. For a moment, they crouched on their hands and knees just outside the door, hanging their heads, panting, wheezing, and hurting. Blood trickled from Grant's left nostril, and he dabbed at it with a sleeve. Very distantly, they heard the jangling of a bell. Nora raked the wild tangle of her hair out of her eyes.
Decompression alarm! Max people will be here in any second!
Grant hauled himself to his feet by the crossbars of the guardrail. He looked down into the hangar at the array of Manta ships.
Which one of you knows how to launch those crates?
Cleave, his complexion shockingly white, pulled himself up.
Not difficult, but you'll need somebody to operate the roof hatch.
Let's go.
Grant looked for a way down. He spotted the metal rungs of a ladder affixed to the wall near the door and swung over the rail. Cleave followed. Kane got to his feet and addressed Nora.
Stay with them.
She cast a worried glance in his direction.
Where are you going?
To find Bridget and Philboyd. You said I could reach the top level of the Citadel by the anti-grav lift, right?
Yes, but the whole area will be crawling with Max's crew.
Kane broke into a jog, feet ringing on the grilled floor of the catwalk.
Do what you can to help here.
Kane!
Kane paused, leaning over the rail and looking down into the hangar. Grant, halfway down the ladder to the floor, stared up at him peevishly.
What now?
Grant slowly lifted his right index finger to his nose and snapped it away in the wry 1% salute. It was a private gesture he and Kane had developed during their years as hard-contact magistrates and reserved for undertakings with small ratios of success. Kane returned it gravely, then pushed away from the railing and started running again. His chest ached, and the muscles in his lower back and thighs throbbed every time he moved his legs, but he kept sprinting, dashing through the circuitry tunnel to the hatch that led out to the cavern. His fingers stabbed at the keypad on the wall, and the slab of metal began to rumble aside. Before the door was a quarter open, he squeezed through and bounded down the stone stairs, taking two at a time. As Kane hit the cavern floor, still running, he glimpsed a cluster of EVA-suited men running across the stone bridge from the opposite side. They shouted when they caught sight of him, but he couldn't hear what they said. He figured it didn't really matter when streams of flaming plasma lashed out toward him. They struck the rock floor, leaving wide scorch marks in a crackling wake. Without breaking stride, legs pumping furiously, Kane raced toward the lift alcove. Before he covered half the distance, a tall, lean figure stepped out of it. The light was too uncertain to discern McCann's expression, but there was no mistaking his gait. He approached Kane with the self-assured manner of a tiger stalking its wounded prey. Kane made an instant and borderline insane decision. He swerved sharply away from McCann, sprinting full speed toward the drainage channel. He heard McCann shouting angrily, probably imprecations at his men. Kane guessed the rounds were coming too close for comfort. The masked fusillade tapered off, but shots were still fired at him. Kane heard a little whump of displaced air as a projectile passed to the right of his face, fanning his cheek with a swish of warm air. He reached the bank of the channel and came to a halt, looking back and forth. From his left came McCann, and from his right rushed at least a dozen weapon-brandishing men. He bent his knees, then straightened them as he dived into the channel. Kane had only time and thought enough to close his mouth and eyes as he struck and disappeared beneath the slowly moving flow of filth. To Grant's almost overwhelming relief, locating the canopy catch release for the Manta's cockpit was no more difficult than the one on Philboyd's flitter gig. While he raised the canopy, Nora and Cleave entered a small glass-walled booth beneath the catwalk and sealed the door. Grant slid down into the pilot seat, giving the cockpit a cursory examination. A bronze-colored helmet with a full-face visor was attached to the headrest of the chair. A pair of tubes stretched to an oxygen tank at the back of the seat. He saw that the chair and helmet were a one-piece self-contained unit. He studied the instrument panel, dismayed by its simplicity. The controls consisted primarily of a joystick, altimeter, and fuel gauges. Quite fortunately, all the labeling was in English, not Sumerian cuneiform, as he had half dreaded. When he slipped the helmet over his head, he realized the simplicity was something of an illusion. He heard the whine of an internal power source juicing up immediately. The interior curve of the helmet's visor swarmed with a squall of glowing pixels. When they cleared a nanosecond later, he had CGI icons of sensor scopes, rangefinders, and various indicators. At the same time, he felt a peculiar shifting pressure around the base of his neck and realized the helmet was automatically extending a lining and seal. As he strapped himself into the chair, he heard a hiss of static and Nora's voice spoke into his ear.
Can you read me?
Turning his head slightly, Grant saw Cleve and Nora within the cubicle. Cleve brandished a control box attached to a thick cable that stretched from the ceiling.
Loud and clear.
I'll open the roof hatch with this. We'll be safe from decompression in here.
That's nice to know.
Grant tried to make sense of the images glowing on the visor's surface.
But it might be a wasted effort, since I don't know how to power up this crate.
He experimented with the joystick, pulling it back slightly, then pushing it forward. As he did so, it caught and clicked into position. The hull began to vibrate around him. On the inside of his helmet flashed the words, VTOL Launch System Enabled.
I found it. Do you hear me?
Instead of an affirmative, loud, frantic voices shouted into his ear. Twisting in the seat, he saw a group of space-suited men descending the ladder from the catwalk above. Nora and Cleve yelled at him to close the canopy and take off. Grant did as they said, pulling down the canopy and latching it tight. Through the tinted shield, he saw Saladin's men rushing across the hangar floor, firing at the glass-enclosed control booth. Bullets smashed into transparent walls, striking a white pattern of stars. Nora ducked, but Cleve still stood with the control box in his hand. The two great leaves of the hangar roof swung upward on a complex arrangement of hinges and pivots. The sky above gleamed with brilliant starlight. As Grant pulled back on the joystick, he hazarded a quick glance toward Cleve. The man gave him a cheery wave just as a storm of bullets struck the glass wall. He was hit in the chest, bright crimson blossoming against the faded green of his coverall. He jerked sideways, but he kept his grip on the box. He clung to it, his head drooping and blood spilling from his lips. A faint cry from Nora entered Grant's helmet. Then it dissolved in a hash of static. With a stomach-sinking swiftness, the manta lifted upward. Despite the situation, Grant couldn't help but be impressed as the tab ascended smoothly, as if drawn by the attraction of a celestial magnet. The helmet's heads-up screens offered different vantage points of the ascent, and Grant's eyes darted from one to another. The manta's vertical climb felt nothing like that of a death bird. He watched as the lunar plains and rocky crags receded so quickly they became mere ripples of contrasting texture and color. High mountain peaks appeared, then shrank to little cones of pumice. Grant pulled back on the control stick, and the acceleration of the lateral thrust smashed down on him, slamming him hard against the back of his chair. The speed gauge icon scrolled with numbers. He pushed the stick forward and then to the left. The manta's velocity slowed and it banked to port. Through the cockpit, it appeared that the tumbled rocky wilderness of the tightly clustered craters wheeled crazily around him. The TAV handled far easier than Grant had expected, much smoother than Filboid's customized cobbled-together craft. He ran through the inventory of all the dials, switches, gauges, and fire controls. His memory went back to the long training sessions involved in learning the operation of the Deathbirds. The principles were the same, but the applications were vastly different. Grant pushed the manta onto a tangential course, heading for space. He had difficulty dividing his concentration between the helmet displays and what lay in the star-speckled blackness, so he missed the first warning of attack. He didn't realize he was being pursued until a streak of fire lanced past his starboard wing. Instantly, Grant upped the craft's velocity and pulled back on the stick, slamming the manta into a screaming climb for altitude. He felt the bones in his face seeming to crack under the stress of acceleration. But at the verge of tolerance, inertia dampers kicked in. He eyed the flashing sensor icon and interpreted the symbols and scrolling digits to mean an enemy craft was climbing into space after him, roaring up from below. He recalled the pilot's slow reaction time in the first TAV he had encountered, but a Fury had been in the cockpit then. He assumed one of Saladin's people, probably better trained, jockeyed this pursuit craft, so he couldn't count on the same kind of incompetence. Under Grant's guidance, the manta performed barrel rolls, loops, and wide swinging yaws, trying to lose the other ship. He alternated the burn times of the port and starboard steering jets, causing the TAV to leap and skitter wildly. The fabric of the ship moaned, quivered, and shuddered. In an instant of terror, Grant thought the craft was breaking up and prepared himself for the whistle of air through ruptured hull plates. But the manta held as Grant put it through its paces. The other ship climbed after him in a whipping spiral. Grant put the TAV into a sharp dive, pulled up equally sharply, reversing an old Deathbird maneuver he called the peel-up-pop-down. The same tactic had worked to confuse the pilot of the TAV he had encountered the day before. The pursuing Mantis ship zipped up and across his course. For the briefest of seconds, the TAV was outlined in his helmet sights, past the crosshairs, and he thumbed the trigger button on the control stick. A missile flamed from its pod sheath on his starboard wing. He felt the craft shudder slightly with the explosive release of the projectile. The missile inscribed a fiery trail, bright against the black backdrop of space, but he saw no explosion. Instead, he saw the flare of incoming fire. He sent the Mantis straight up, engines at full thrust, and over on its back, a half roll. The rocket sketched a wavering track well below him. Shoving the joystick forward, Grant dropped the ship in a sharp feint and came rushing up on the enemy Manta from below and behind. The sensor scope targeted the TAV, and he launched two missiles. Hit, he thought savagely. Hit! Neither one did. He traced the projectile's paths out beyond the range of the scope and snarled in self-disgust. He now faced a double problem. He had only two missiles remaining, and he couldn't afford to waste both of them on the enemy craft, nor could he take the time to engage in a protracted dogfight. He craned his neck around, looking for the enemy vessel, and caught a fragmented glimpse of it at least a mile to the northeast. He couldn't be sure if the pilot knew his intended destination, but he figured he had some kind of idea. Otherwise, he wouldn't have bothered coming after him. All right, asshole, he thought grimly. Let's give you something bigger to play with. Grant pulled the control stick backward, and the sudden surge of acceleration slammed against his chest. If not for the oxygen filtering into his helmet, all the wind would have been knocked out of his lungs. When he saw the next missile coming, a butt of destruction loosed by the enemy craft, he dropped his ship's speed a fraction. The projectile blazed across his bow, missing it by a fractional margin. Then he veered up, opening full throttle. Within a minute, the mass detector icon began flashing. Grant changed course a few degrees, one eye on the computer-generated image inside his helmet and the other on the starlit tapestry beyond the port. He saw something ahead of him, solid and dark, a blacker blot against space. He nudged the control stick to starboard, and then he saw it clearly, its rough curves highlighted by the sun. The Devil platform loomed before him, a plate-shaped mass of ancient, rust-pitted slabs of metal, crudely welded together. It hung there like a deformed negative image of the moon far below. Grant edged the Manta closer, wondering what the enemy pilot had to be thinking. He figured the sight of the Devil device must be something of a shock to him. He prayed he knew nothing about the plasmoid defense array Filboid had talked about. Maneuvering his craft in wide swinging orbit around the hulk, Grant's belly turned tight and cold. He expected a blaze of fire from the rusty mass at any second, but as he completed the first circuit around it, nothing happened. It occurred to him that the platform's armaments could have gone offline many years before, unbeknownst to anyone. As it was, the huge hunk of slapped-together debris looked about as fearsome as some old junkyards he had seen. He dropped the speed and the nose of the Manta so he could fly beneath it and locate the generator. As he did so, he saw the enemy TAV cleaving a path on a direct course toward him. The ship was so close, Grant thought he could almost make out the shape of the pilot behind the sweeping curve of the canopy. He struggled frantically to align the craft in his targeting scope. Space was suddenly laced with a hellish web of pure energy, deadly beams stabbing out in a hellfire barrage. At first, Kane could not touch the bottom. He clawed the slime aside, floundering more than swimming, until he entered the tunnel in the cavern wall, almost wishing McCann's men hadn't stopped shooting at him. If one of them had scored a lucky hit, at least he would have been put out of his misery. He kept his head above the surface, trying not to breathe any more than was necessary. The darkness was total. Slimy objects brushed him, clung to him, and now and again, he took a breath. The sewer, the cloaca for a dying colony, was as near to his notion of hell as he ever wished to come. The current, sluggish at first, began to quicken and bear him along. He floated through the quagmire of putridity, rounded a bend, and saw a glimmer of light just ahead. But it was light only in the relative sense. It was a patch of gray against the absolute dark seeping down from above. A heavy weight bumped into him, and he pushed it away, recognizing it as the headless body of Majira. Kane's toes touched bottom, and he could now walk, more or less, keeping his chin above the slime. Within a few moments, he was only shoulder deep. He kept a hand on the rock wall as he waded. He rounded a bend and looked at the pipeline stretching away before him. It was far narrower than the channel, but far, far away, he saw the source of the light. Standing shoulder deep in the ghastly brew of human waste and corpses, he decided he had no choice but to enter. He walked in a stooped posture, and the bruises from the crash of the TAV and those inflicted by McCann pained him. The tube curved ahead, featureless except for water dripping from its circular walls. The smell of rotting vegetation was very strong. Kane didn't allow his thoughts to dwell on Grant or Nora and Cleve. He could only hope everything had gone according to plan, but he doubted it had. Within a minute, he came to the junction with another sewer pipe. Water flowed out of it in a rushing current around his body. It smelled comparatively clean, and it swept him and the stinking sludge along. A deluge of water poured through the adjacent tube, the current dragging at his legs. He fell down and was pushed along, rolling with the flow. He did his best to keep his head above the water, staring up at the tunnel's roof, looking for the light source. When he saw the iron-rimmed circle through which light shafted, Kane stroked furiously for the side of the pipe. He seized the bottom rung of the short, rust-eaten ladder and hooked his arms through it. Water spumed and splashed around him, the level rising fast. The water rose against him, trying to force him up to the ceiling of the pipe. Hand over hand, Kane scaled the ladder. The current suddenly doubled in speed and force, sweeping his feet out from under him. He managed to retain his grip on the ladder, but the flood tide caught him, pulling him into a horizontal position, his back bumping the top of the tube. Kane fought the rush of water with flailing legs, dragging himself up the ladder, fearing that he would lose his grip and be washed out onto the lunar surface. Another surge of water, this one eddying up from below, slammed him upward. He doubled over as if he had received a punch in the stomach, but his hands still gripped the rungs of the ladder. He was swept up, and he burst out the tube. His shoulder scraped against the edges of the opening. The rim of the opening fetched him a painful crack across the crown of his head as he was forced up and out. Water spumed, sprayed, and foamed all around him, his body buffeted by the surging upward current. Kane felt himself being hurled full tilt, head over heels. Then he lay on yielding ground, spitting out water and drinking in great lungfuls of air. He sensed warm, humid air touching his skin like soft hands. Slowly, he pushed himself to his hands and knees, blinking at his surroundings. The air was still and thick, hung with veils of steamy mist. The mossy ground was dotted with algae-covered puddles all around. Vegetation grew on all sides of him, and Kane realized he was in one of the hydroponic farms established by the moon base colonists. He got to his feet, looked up, and saw nothing but a high roof half cloaked by steam. He set off through the undergrowth, hoping he was heading in a useful direction. Kane had not gone more than a score of yards when from somewhere ahead of him came the steady swish of vegetation being pushed aside. Instantly, he sank into a crouch, tilting his head, straining his ears. He heard nothing for a handful of seconds and was about to stand up again. Then he detected the stealthy pad of footsteps. He tensed himself to spring up and run. From behind him, McCann spoke mildly.
Far too late for the harvest.
Bridget Baptiste and Phil Boyd went forward, step by step, into the darkness of the hall, flanked on either side by the Furies. Monolithic slabs of stone stood in two rows, arranged to curve around and meet in a circle. They were hung with tapestries worked in multicolored threads that depicted scenes from ancient times, ziggurats from which sprouted terraced gardens, animals long extinct, human and non-human faces. They offered brief glimpses into a world lost millennia ago, when the Anunnaki were the gods of the earth. In the center of the monoliths rose a dais. It seemed at first to be some strange work of sculpture, but as Bridget drew nearer, she saw with a quiver of dread it was more akin to a throne. Directly above the platform revolved a huge globe made of a softly gleaming alloy. Continents and land masses rose in relief over its curving skin. At least 10 feet in diameter, it hung in a supporting web of slender metal girders. Sprouting from its smooth surface were dozens of delicate crystal rods, shimmering, twisting, turning, stretching out, bending in on themselves at angles. She had seen something like it once before, and though it might resemble a work of art, it wasn't. Inscribed on the floor at the foot of the dais were dozens of the spiral and cup glyphs, each one 3 feet in circumference. The Furies directed Phil Boyd to stand within one, while the other black-clad figure pushed Bridget into its mate, an equal distance from it. Bolted to the stone inside each of the glyphs were manacles of dark metal. The Furies fastened these about their ankles. A moan of panic bubbled past Phil Boyd's lacerated lips. Bridget regarded him sternly.
"Stay with me, Phil Boyd."
A Fury took Majira's head from Bridget's hands and marched to the foot of the dais, where the shadows swallowed him. The second Fury stood motionless between Phil Boyd and Bridget, his blank face turned in the direction his companion had taken. He seemed to be ignoring them, so Bridget returned the favor.
"Phil Boyd, are you keeping it together?"
He nodded, touching his chest and wincing.
Trying to. If I lose consciousness, it doesn't mean I faint in from fear. It means I pass out from pain. So don't call me a wussy.
She smiled in appreciation.
So noted.
Phil Boyd craned his neck, studying the big globe hanging overhead.
What the hell is that thing?
I believe it's a Danann map. Or so I was told when I saw one like it in Ireland.
Map of what?
Quantum pathways. Interface junctures, what we now call parallax points. According to what I was told, thousands of years ago, the Tuatha De Danann and the Anunnaki mapped them out. If you look at it closely, you'll see the patterns are three-dimensional depictions of the cup and spiral markings.
Phil Boyd cocked his head from side to side.
Yeah, I think I see it. They're oriented to cardinal points on the Earth, mathematical correlations of landmasses and regions.
He turned his head toward her.
If it's a Danann artifact, then what's it doing here?
She shrugged, then tried to lift her leg, testing the manacles. The Fury shifted position, pointed his Ubalus rod, and she subsided.
There apparently are a lot of things I don't understand about the relationship between the Anunnaki and the Tuatha De Danann. But before I leave this place, I intend to.
Phil Boyd made a wheezing, gargling noise, and she looked toward him alarmed, fearing he was hemorrhaging internally. Then she realized he was trying to chuckle.
Even if it's the last thing you do?
Exactly.
They heard a slow shuffling of feet from the dais, and both people tensed. The Fury appeared, but he didn't carry the severed head. He assumed a guard position beside Phil Boyd, but the shuffling went on. Bridget and Phil Boyd stared, waiting. Bridget found herself laboring for breath as if she had just run a 3-minute mile. She feared, yet was desperate to see who or what approached them from the gloom. Despite her best efforts, she felt the cold beginnings of terror. McCann's suggestion about the knife seemed less patronizingly facetious now. She wished she hadn't left it in the Carnobot. A man-shaped figure moved slowly into the dim light, limping as if crippled. Gradually, the figure moved closer. The dim light gleamed dully from an intricate pattern of tiny, glittering scales. Bridget bit back a cry of shock and revulsion. Even seeing Enlil's preserved corpse in New London had not prepared her for the flesh-and-blood vision of Enki, last of the Serpent Kings, the final dragon lord, as he slowly crept out of the murk. He stood taller than Grant, erect upon great, hound-like legs. From downsloping shoulders dangled long arms, the four fingers tipped with spurs of discolored bone. Within his hands he clasped Majira's head, holding it close to him as if it were a precious treasure. His neck was longer than a human's, the head blunt of feature with a wide, lipless mouth. The narrow, elongated skull held large, almond-shaped eyes, black vertical slits centered in the golden, opalescent irises. The eyes were almost invisible under knobbed brow ridges. Mind reeling, Bridget recalled her discussions with Lakesh about how the similarity between Balaam's folk and the traditional images of demons may have accounted for the instant enmity that sprang up between humans and his people. Lakesh opined that since ancient depictions of imps, elves, and djinn were more than likely based on early encounters between Balaam's folk and primitive man, humans weren't capable of reaching an accord with creatures who resembled archetypal figures of evil. Upon seeing Enki, Bridget realized that Balaam's people, those known as the First Folk and then later the Archons, were adorable cherubs compared to the utterly alien, inhuman aura this entity radiated. She forced herself to look full upon his face. Pride was stamped there, as well as a dark wisdom. She sensed loneliness, too, and understood dimly that he was old, so old that his soul wearied of trying to dredge up memories of youth. Enki continued to shuffle forward, dragging a deformed 3-toed foot behind him. The leg was twisted, gnarled at the ankle. He stopped, and his head swiveled slowly from Bridget to Phil Boyd, then back to Bridget again. He breathed heavily, laboriously. When his voice came, it wasn't the liquidy, snake-like hiss Bridget had half expected. It was soft and quiet, cold and clear.
Children, I would have you know I am not your enemy. I make no war on your kind, but a battle must be fought, nevertheless.
flurry of plasmoids reminded Grant of giant phosphorescent bees swarming from their hive and converging on him like a blizzard. He maneuvered the Manta in a fast bank, tipping the craft up on its portside wing. The cockpit suddenly flared with a burst of almost blinding white light. A plasmoid skated past, less than a yard above the canopy. He put the Manta into a tight corkscrewing spin, spiraling down toward the bone-white, pocked face of the moon's surface. More bursts of light flashed into the cockpit. Each burst was followed by blackness as the tab continued to spin, the plasmoid barrage following him down. When the flashes ceased, Grant pulled back on the joystick, steadying the ship and climbing out of the dive. Even as he did, he saw a missile etch a trail of flame against the background of stars. The projectile seared past his fuselage very close, but not as close as the buds of destructive energy loosed by the Devil platform. The missile continued on its downward arc, impacting with a puffball of flame and smoke in the center of the crater far below. Grant swung around in a sharp loop. He glimpsed the enemy Manta ship banking off his starboard side, trying to achieve a parallel course. Grant accelerated, arrowing back toward the hulking sphere of the Devil device. It hung above him like some dark god, untouchable and omnipotent. The other Tav kept up with him, edging ahead to cut him off. Grant allowed him to advance, reducing his speed and then pushing the Manta into a shallow dive. The craft soared past overhead and triggered the mass proximity sensors aboard the platform. The plasmoid battery let loose, peppering the path of the enemy ship. The pilot pushed his craft into a steep climb, almost standing in on its tail assembly. He performed a wide barrel roll, came out of it as twin missiles flamed from the ship's wings. Grant slid his Manta as close as he dared to the outer border of the plasmoid. The globes of energy intersected with the missiles' paths and both of the projectiles exploded, washing Grant's cockpit with a flood of orange light. Grant pulled up sharply to avoid flying through the expanding, roiling ball of flame. He swung the Manta around and down again, coming in from below and behind the enemy vessel. It veered away, climbing fast. The pilot seemed to have finally caught on to his strategy of luring him close enough to the Devil platform so its self-defense measures would either drive him off or destroy him. A coruscating white globe swelled in Grant's viewport. In a fraction of a second, he noted how swiftly the plasmoid rotated, little tongues of flame tearing off from it. The closer it came, the more it seemed to elongate until it resembled a shimmering cylinder, not a ball. Grant jerked back on the stick, but the ship shook from stem to stern as the plasmoid struck the fuselage a glancing blow. Static discharges crackled inside the cockpit, and he felt them even through his suit, as if a million ants crawled along his body. Despite the helmet's faceplate and his own impaired sense of smell, the sharp sting of ozone cut into his nostrils. He curved the Manta away from the platform just as the plasmoid batteries were triggered again. He felt the ship shudder beneath multiple impacts before he was able to whisk the craft down and away. A pattern of scorch mark holes had appeared on the portside wing. He twisted the stick, kicked the rudder, and the Manta gained speed. Grant made the ship descend, and he kicked up the speed to maximum. He made an almost vertical bank, and the Manta plunged directly back toward the platform. The craft vibrated dangerously as he continued to push it at peak speed. He kicked the rudder and waggled the wings, tilting the craft from side to side in a controlled yaw as he lanced beneath the platform, tipping up one wing then the other to present a smaller target for the plasmoid salvo. As he roared beneath the underside of Devil, he craned his neck upward and saw the top cube of the fusion reactor protruding from between the plates of rust-streaked metal. As he came out on the far side of the platform, the enemy Manta was waiting for him. A missile sprang toward him, but a swarm of plasmoids surrounded it and intercepted its course. For a second, it looked like two swords of light crossing in the night. Then the missile vanished in a billowing cloud of flame. Grant saw the fireball spreading out toward him, and there was nothing he could do but grit his teeth and plummet through it. Beyond the viewport, he saw fiery veils curling past, whipped like radioactive sea mist over his onrushing bow. Something struck the ship, most likely a fragment of missile casing. Then he was in clear space again. He gusted out a relieved sigh, ignoring the beads of sweat collecting between his temples and the helmet's lining. Grant looked around for the enemy Tav, glimpsed it hovering no more than 100 yards away, and banked toward it. To his surprise, he saw how the pilot mimicked the maneuver, trying to maintain a wide distance between the two ships. He guessed the craft was all out of missiles, but some compulsion kept the pilot from retreating. Grant debated whether to ignore him and devote his full concentration to taking out the reactor, or chase the ship off, perhaps even risking one of his two missiles on removing his adversary from the equation altogether. Before he made up his mind, the pilot took the decision out of his hands. The enemy Manta performed a fast hardabout and plunged toward him, as if the ship were the head of an arrow loosed from a compound bow. It pitched up on its starboard wing, slashing through space like a flying axe blade. It followed an unmistakable collision course. At the sound of McCann's voice, Kane didn't hesitate. Balancing himself on the palms of his hands, Kane thrust his legs backward, slamming a reverse heel kick into McCann's kneecaps. As McCann went down, crying out in surprised anger, Kane sprang to his feet, put his head back and his chest out, and ran as he had run very few times in his life. As he plunged among the crops of the hydroponic farm, he realized he had no problem admitting to himself that McCann scared him badly. Whatever he was, Danann, human, or something in between, McCann was definitely mad with an undeniable taste for murder. Kane ran through the sluggish, humid air, splashing through puddles of stagnant water, trampling what appeared to be stalks of corn. He squinted through the mist, trying to get his bearings and chart his escape. The steam was too thick for him to see the source of the light, but he sensed it wasn't far overhead, and therefore he figured he'd reach a bulkhead or a wall before long. Suddenly, he stumbled and threw out his hands to grab the stalks. They snapped and he fell heavily. He remained on his knees for a moment, listening, measuring the noise he had to have made. He doubted it was much, but then McCann's hearing was far more keen than his own. Almost as soon as the thought registered, Kane heard McCann's blood-chilling laugh float through the mist. He couldn't determine its direction, so he continued to crouch among the plants.
Clumsy as most humans. As much as I admired your breed's courage, I found your gracelessness almost intolerable.
Kane wanted to remind him of who had been the recipient of a leg sweep, but he elected to remain silent.
I don't understand why you're fleeing or where you hope to flee. There's nothing you can accomplish. You're like a half-drowned rat trapped in a maze, a crazed monkey entangled in a net. I suppose I should just leave you alone, let you stumble around. But there's always a chance, however remote, you could do something to cause me problems. All humans eventually caused me problems, even the ones I married. Especially the ones I married. Besides, this is a spot of fun to brighten up an otherwise dismal day. Rather like the fox hunts I used to enjoy back when your kind kissed my ass instead of trying to set it on fire.
Kane crept forward very slowly and carefully, not even daring to breathe hard, using McCann's voice to cover the sounds of his progress. When he stopped speaking, Kane stopped moving. There was a long pause, and Kane tensed, expecting to see McCann towering over him out of the steam. However, when he spoke again, he didn't sound any closer.
I understand your fright, but what will happen is actually for the best, you know. It wasn't an easy decision for either Enki or I to reach, but factoring in even the most extreme variables, we had no other choice. Do you know that out of all the other races in the galaxy, the human race is actually the most recent? That's why you were organized in the manner you were, to keep you safe. By the time my people arrived on Earth, we had 4 million years of accumulated history to reflect upon, and we found much of it wanting. We were able to identify our mistakes. Of course, by then we had reached the limit of our development. When we met your kind, we were so delighted with you. We adored the immensity of your potential.
As McCann spoke, Kane crawled forward, only half listening, more alert for the times McCann paused than his actual words.
In all the stewardship arrangements with the Anunnaki, we were the happiest with this one. We decided not to rule you from afar, as Enki's folk had done, but to go among you, maintaining a certain distance, of course. So we put aside our machines, our instruments and weapons, and tried to make you believe we were essentially the same as you. We became examples to inspire you, to instill in you aspirations to exceed your Anunnaki-bred limitations.
Ahead of him, in between the plants, Kane saw the flat gray expanse of a bulkhead, glistening with moisture. He crawled swiftly to it, touching it, looking to the left and right. A score of feet away, he saw the steel collar of a circular hatch protruding from the wall. Swiftly, he made his way toward it, found a keypad control, and pressed a key colored green. Lights danced within the keys, and a gasketed pressure lock separated with a shuddering clank he felt through the soles of his boots. Kane winced at the sound. The hatch irised open, releasing a puff of cold air and an eerie whistling sound. He saw a chute stretching away at a gradually inclining angle. Regularly placed light rings on the chute's ribbing cast a sickly yellow-green illumination. Kane entered the tunnel, pushed the keys on the inner wall, and the hatch cover closed. With a breathless curse, he realized immediately the interior of the cylinder held an atmosphere, but only a rarefied gravity. The inner walls of the chute came equipped with staple-shaped rungs, by which he pulled himself along. Behind him, he heard the clanking hiss of the hatch opening, and he twisted his head as the iris widened. McCann dived through, his scarred face split by a grin.
Tally-ho!
His eyes gleamed against the pallor of his face like a pair of blood-drenched rubies.
Battle? With whom? You?
Enki did not reply. Slowly, he turned Majira's head in his hands so her blistered face and sightless eyes gazed up at him in silent worship.
Which one of you did this to her?
At the periphery of her vision, Brigid saw Philboyd sag with the weight of horror. He apparently expected Enki to exact vengeance at any moment, and she wasn't at all sure he was not correct.
Neither one of us. It was McCann's doing.
Enki nodded as if the answer was no surprise. His ophidian eyes were full of sorrow.
Just so, just so. She was mad, yes, I know. As was her grandmother who first found me. She went mad with the knowledge I imparted to you, and passed both the insanity and the knowledge down from generation to generation. My final legacy to humanity. Yet for all of that, she was loyal to me. It was the one quality you humans possessed that was beyond our understanding. We placed little value on it then.
Brigid forced herself to stare directly into Enki's inhuman face.
Were you the one who inspired her to go out and pass judgment on sinners? Were you the one who commanded her to grant salvation through pain and terror?
Enki's lips stretched in what she hoped was a smile.
Majira, all three of them, did as she did of her own free will. I did not inspire or command her to use Anunnaki tools for her own crazed ends. Free will was an inborn trait of your kind, exhibited even in the earlier protoform of your development. My brother Enlil wanted it bred out of you, but I opposed him.
Brigid stood very still, too fascinated for the moment to be afraid.
He thought me a sentimental fool, and time proved him right. I learned of my own folly too late. Learned that the pupils to whom we gave the seeds of knowledge had grown too clever.
Enlil is dead.
Enki's eyes flickered with a touch of emotion. She could almost have called it envy, and when he spoke, there was wistfulness in his voice.
Yes, Enlil is dead. They are all dead. Ninurata, Ninhursag, Shamash, even grand and glorious Ea. Only I remain.
Philboyd finally spoke. In a voice so low, Brigid barely heard him.
Why?
Enki turned slightly toward him with a sound like the rustling of dry leaves.
Why do you remain?
It was my duty. I was charged to remain until Nibiru completed its orbital cycle.
And then?
And then make it young again, as when my race stood tall and proud.
He paused, and a surprisingly human tongue darted from his mouth to dab at his lips.
Tall and proud and arrogant.
You've been here on the moon for over 3,000 years?
Enki nodded thoughtfully, then shook his head.
I can no longer be sure of anything in regards to the passage of time. When we were released from stasis 2 centuries before the pre-appointed time, without the proper reconditioning, our minds were confused.
We?
McCann.
Enki turned away in a slow, painful shamble. Brigid glimpsed the short, vestigial tail dangling from the base of his spine.
Unlike me, McCann was banished here by his own people. And like me, he was weary of abiding by the terms of the pact and sought to change them.
Enki limped toward the shadowed dais, a silent signal the conversation was over. Brigid shifted position.
Enki, wait!
Enki continued limping away.
Enki, I've got to know.
The tall, scaled figure paused, not speaking or turning his head toward her.
Enki, I have to know about you. Even if I'm fated to die in the next few hours, you must tell me about your race. You must share your knowledge.
A peculiar sibilant hissing came from Enki. He turned back around to face her, his throat pulsing strangely. If Brigid could have recoiled in fearful revulsion, she would have. Then, with a start of surprise, she realized Enki was laughing.
Knowledge. Oh, yes, I have much knowledge. I know everything my race knew, no matter how trivial or shameful. I've suffered with it for centuries piled upon centuries. When your kind labored to build pyramids in the Nile Valley, I suffered. If I could forget all that I know and thus end the suffering, I would happily do so.
Enki moved closer, dragging his crippled foot.
I'll share my knowledge, and perhaps a bit of the agony my soul suffers because of it. You would like that?
I would.
Without preamble, Enki began speaking of a race that had grown to maturity on a world already in its death throes. In planetary terms, Nibiru was drawing its final breath. Its wild orbit caused it to be unusually variable as to heat and cold, and caused drastic weather changes, geological upheavals, and gravity disruptions. But in biological terms, Nibiru's final breath was long enough for the Anunnaki to evolve from a race of Saurian bipeds into a prosperous, even magnificent civilization. If life on any planet in any solar system was a rigorous, merciless test of survival of the fittest, it was on Nibiru, and the Anunnaki passed. They did not allow nature to stand in their way. As on Earth, adaptability was the primary key to survival. They conquered their wild environment, but they were not conquerors by nature. They were organizers first and foremost, and they tamed Nibiru by organizing themselves, learning to subsist on the resources of a nearly depleted world. When the Anunnaki mastered spaceflight, and then the secret of hyperdimensional travel, they turned to the other worlds in the solar system to supply the deficits of their own. Brigid knew that part of the story, or at least the Danann version of it, as imparted by the speaking stone of Kaskorak. Her eidetic memory was prodded by Enki's words to bring forth the images telepathically impressed into her mind on that day. Again, she saw the images of shapes moving across the smoky, sooty sky of ancient Earth. Boom arms swinging in slow circles, black objects crawling along glistening tracks, buildings and factory complexes, the foundations of which stretched deep beneath the surface. The Anunnaki tapped the core of the planet itself for the generation of pure energy. Once Earth was modified, the indigenous protohumans were remolded. They were graded at rough intellectual levels, classified by physique, agility, and dexterity. Once the selection of the best was completed, the process of creating a kindred yet superior species began. The first generation of slave labor was only a step above the indigenous hominid species, and they were encouraged to breed, so each successive descendant might be superior. Also, children made the best slaves, because they knew no other kind of life. The brains improved, and technical skills grew. And so did cogent thoughts and the ability to deal with abstract concepts. Sluggish mental activities increased exponentially in speed and depth, prompting the construction of ideas that eventually led to the formation of restlessness and dissatisfaction. The Anunnaki failed to notice this expansion of cognition on the part of their slaves. As an essentially peaceful race, they viewed violence as unproductive and a waste of resources. They were exploiters, not conquerors. Eventually, because revolution was the product of frustration, rebellion came. Even Earth turned into an unprofitable enterprise, so the Anunnaki arranged for a catastrophe to destroy their labor force. The catastrophe was recorded in ancient texts and even cultural memories as the Flood. But this was not an easy decision to reach among the Anunnaki, and they factionalized over it. Enlil, ever the persecutor of humanity, was opposed by Enki. Although he took covert steps to ensure there would be human survivors of the catastrophe, he had no choice but to leave Earth with the rest of his brethren. Enki and a small group of supporters had become attached to Earth and its inhabitants, and were overwhelmed with guilt and remorse. They could not return to Nibiru or any of their outposts on the other planets and live in peace with Enlil and the others who had approved and engineered the near genocide of humankind. Over the course of the centuries on Earth, their perceptions about life had changed. They acquired a new need, a new passion, that sent groups of them across the widest gulfs of space. They had stopped seeking power and even knowledge, and found themselves driven by a motivation grander than the simple survival of their race, a motivation to aid the development and fulfillment of all sentient life.
We could not undo what had been done to your kind, nor could we keep to ourselves what we had achieved. So we thought to share it. We thought of life forms springing into being all over the universe, evolving races that needed our knowledge, and even the vast distances between the stars would not hold us back. Having acquired all the skills and technology that we were capable of acquiring, we spread across the galaxy, driven by a need to rectify our crime against humanity.
Enki paused, his eyes briefly veiled by his deeply wrinkled lids. He shook his blunt-featured head, as if trying to rid it of ugly memories.
And then, the worst disaster imaginable befell my people. We met the Tuahat at Anan.
Enki opened his eyes, jerking his head back as if surprised to see Bridget and Filboid standing before him. From his mouth issued a stream of jumbled consonants. The Furies immediately dropped to their knees, but not in benediction. Swiftly, they opened the manacles around Filboid's and Bridget's ankles. Both people were too shocked to speak. Enki turned toward the dais, pivoting on his good leg.
Humanity has been in shackles long enough. You will come with me.
The two ships were almost on top of each other. According to the measurements scrolling madly within Grant's helmet, they were. Swearing coarsely, he jerked the control stick and veered out of the path of the approaching Manta. Its edge-on wing missed cleaving through his cockpit canopy like a butcher knife by less than a yard. The two ships sprang apart, swerving right and left, up and down, circling the Devil platform in a wide arc as if it were the hub of a wheel. A grid of hairlines glowed across the visor of Grant's helmet, and a tiny bead of light, a digital copy of the enemy ship, zipped to and fro through the little computer-generated opticals. The Devil platform continued to spit plasmoids, but their frequency seemed to be tapering off, and Grant wondered if the batteries were close to exhausted. Twice his craft shuddered under the impact of glancing hits, but they did little more than shake him up a little. The energies they contained seemed weak, little more than electrified snowballs. The pilot of the other Manta ship posed a far more immediate threat. He seemed to pay no heed to the pulses of energy, fixated as he was on crashing his craft into Grant's. It was no longer a dogfight. It was a protracted game of tag, and Grant wasn't enjoying it one bit. With an angry reluctance, he realized he had no choice but to sacrifice one of his two missiles to blast the pursuing ship out of space. As it approached him again on another suicide run, Grant threw his vessel into a dizzy corkscrew spin, right between the Devil platform and the nose of the other ship. The blazing volley of plasmoids missed him entirely but tracked the enemy craft. The ship veered sharply away from the salvo, looped, and returned to engage Grant again. A flurry of plasmoids streaked toward both ships like a glowing sleet storm. The enemy vessel began an evasive turn, but two bolts struck dead on target amidships. Another ball from the Devil platform touched the Manta's rear guidance assembly, fragmenting it and all but shearing it away. The ship spun helplessly, its stabilizers obviously knocked out. Grant didn't hesitate. He lined up the wobbling ship in his helmet's crosshairs and thumbed the launch stud. The missile roared out of the starboard side wing pod in a flare of flame. It streaked in a straight line to impact against the Manta's topside fuselage, right where the curve of the cockpit canopy spread out to merge with the wings. It exploded in a boom of flame and metal fragments. The Manta ship flipped into a crazy sideways wing-over-wing roll, strewing space with flying shards of canopy and engine parts. The craft tumbled in a careening barrel roll. The fuel tank ignited on the fourth roll with a detonation that swallowed the bodywork in a mushroom of roiling flame. The ship disintegrated in a shower of hardware, both of its backswept wings wrenched loose and cartwheeled in opposite directions. Grant's ship shuddered and shook from the shockwave. He repressed a snarl of savage satisfaction, turning it into a sigh of relief instead. Manipulating the joystick, he flew straight up, standing the Manta on its tail, then dropped the nose, plunging back down toward the Devil platform, intending to fly far beneath it, then come up directly from below. Several of the plasmoid batteries appeared to be exhausted. Only two had fired at the enemy vessel, but the energies were at full strength. He completed the maneuver perfectly, pulling out of the dive with the same smooth, effortless grace of a hawk skimming across the surface of a pond. He soared upward, thumb hovering over the trigger button on the joystick. Carefully, he nosed the ship into a 90-degree angle relative to the position of the Devil platform's underbelly. Just as carefully, he aligned the protruding cube of the generator with his helmet's optical targeting system. His eyes were fixed on the cube as it loomed larger and larger in the center of the canopy. His thumb rested on the missile stud, waiting, holding his breath. Then, when the image of the cube completely filled the crosshairs on the inner curve of his helmet's visor, he depressed the button. And nothing happened. He snarled out a curse and pressed it again and again, receiving only a series of impotent clicks for his efforts. In a fraction of a second, he realized the plasmoid strikes had disrupted the circuitry to the missile launch commands. His thoughts rolled loosely in his head like dropped marbles, but he didn't alter course or decrease his speed. Then lightning flashed in a jagged arc from above him, and his legs shuddered brutally and rocked. He pulled back on the stick, but the ship kept to its course, the controls locked and frozen. A crack spread across the canopy, and as he watched in horrified, breathless fascination, the crack became a spiderweb network. For a microsecond, he heard grisly jangling and crunching noises, and the canopy blew outward in a shower of razor-edged shards. Grant thought of Shizuka and her Bushido code and wondered if she would think this particular death was an honorable one. He decided to forestall that judgment as long as he could. When the Manta was only 200 yards away from the top of the cube, Grant wrenched at the lever beneath the pilot's chair. The explosive pop of the eject rocket lasted only a shaved sliver of a second. A giant boot seemed to kick him in the rear and catapult him out and upward. He found himself plunging toward the floating debris of the enemy ship. The Manta continued on its upward course, on a direct heading with the generator. Grant watched as it plummeted into it, its nose flattened, turning up on itself, the hull splitting like a banana skin. The resultant flare from the engines was so bright that he averted his face. Then the missile, its warhead already armed, detonated with a rolling billow of flame, draping the underside of the Devil platform in a blanket of fire. For an instant, it appeared to Grant that even the stars themselves took flame.